From a series of lectures organized at the Harvard Medical School in February 2006, this is Howard Frumpkin from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention speaking about how we could make our cities more livable and the problems that we have when cities are not designed to human scale.
It's my pleasure and my honor to introduce one of my very best friends, Harry Frumpkin, as the next speaker, and you also have his biography, and will note that of among other things, he's been professor and chair of occupational environmental health at Emory University for over 10 years, graduated from here with his doctoral degree in epidemiology, his MD, and trained in internal medicine and environmental occupational medicine. And last year, the day after he took the job as the director of the National Center for Environmental Health, one of the centers at the Centers for Disease Control, Katrina happened. And what was supposed to be a gentle introduction to the agency turned into one of the largest fires to fight ever in the CDC. And he performed quite beautifully. But I know Howard as my fellow co-conspirator, the creator of the International Brotherhood of Howies. We started that when we were freshmen together in college, having not met many people named Howie before and feeling like we had a commonality that required a certain esprit de corps. But Howie and I also had many opportunities to develop this interest and passion in environmental health. And took a year off in the middle of medical school to come here together to do our MPH degree, part of a life-defining event, and we've had an opportunity to travel together. And I could just go on for many hours, but the reason he is here is because he has been this leading-edge thinker in expanding the horizon of environmental health well beyond the confines of traditional thinking. Where he has been going is developing this sense of what is our environment, or what is sense of place, how do we define the urban environment where half the world is rapidly moving towards living in, and why shouldn't we think of the urban environment in its more holistic sense? The way it looks, the way it feels, the way we walk, the way we design our cities, the way it relates to cars, the way we get to places to and fro, should that also be part of what we think of as the environment as it impacts on our health? So he's been working on this for years and has developed this as a critical area of academic inquiry, and he's going to share with you his thoughts about that as part of this course. Howard.
Thank you very much, Howie, and good afternoon, everybody. It's really a thrill to be here. It's a thrill to be at a course that is taught by the wonderful teachers that you all have here. It's a thrill to follow Andy Revkin, who is really one of the finest science writers and a national treasure in this country. I knew all of that before, but I didn't realize that one of those first pictures was very striking. I didn't realize that a national treasure could actually start out as a long-haired guy holding a fish in the Southern Pacific. So it just shows that national treasures emerge from all kinds of images. Well, I want to. I have a lot that I want to try to go through. I may skip parts of it to get us finished when I need to be finished. What time frame should we think about? When do we want to break for discussion, and then when do we want to go off to the classrooms? 5-0 minutes. Okay. So I'm gonna zoom through some of this, and then hopefully we'll have time for discussion. I'm gonna focus on the urban environment, on the city, as a particular human habitat, a human environment. And in a way, this is going to bookend what Andy talked about nicely. He ranged from the South Pacific to the North Pole and didn't have a lot to say about the city. He talked about parts of the world that are sparsely inhabited and non-urban. I'm going to talk about the parts of the world that are more densely inhabited and urban. And then I hope in the discussion section we can bring these two pieces together, because there actually are some very profound connections between the two. I'm going to talk about cities on a global scale first, and then I'm going to focus for most of my time on the American city, which is different than the global city in ways that you probably already know, and I'll try to explain. So I'll begin by talking about what's a city. That's the phenomenon of urbanicity, or the fact of urbanicity, and I'll talk about the process of urbanization, because a city is not just a static phenomenon, but things change in a process called urbanization. I'm going to talk about the city as an environmental phenomenon, and then talk about the city as a health phenomenon. And since this is a course that has a focus on health, I'm going to spend a lot of my time thinking about the health aspects of cities. Well, what's a city? A city is a place where people live with a relatively high density. And that's really all you have to say. There are lots of definitions. For me, that's a simple one. Urbanization is a process by which places become denser and people gather in cities. And so when we look at an American city like Boston, we can define it as the dense part of Boston that's politically defined by urban boundaries. We can define it as the megalopolis that extends way out into the suburbs. Or you can define it as the northern end of Bosniwash, which is a several hundred mile long urban concatenation. And any of those is an okay definition of a city, depending on the needs to which you want to put your the uses to which you need to put your definition. Urbanization is probably more important to think about as the process of change in developing nations, because what we're seeing is a mass transfer of population globally from rural areas to urban areas, so that cities are growing fast. And that process of change is so disruptive and so difficult that the change process itself deserves our attention, as well as the cities and the habitats that result. A little bit of data on global patterns. The blue line is urban population. The red line is rural population. This is a very simple distinction just between two. This is from the population reports that come out of Hopkins. What you can see here is the two lines cross in something like the year 2005, 2002. Some reports say 2020. Data aren't good from many parts of the world, but something like 50% of the world's population is urban now, and that proportion is growing. The proportion that's rural is declining. So people are moving from rural areas to urban areas worldwide. You've heard about the phenomenon of megacities. This is a hard graphic to look at, but the bottom panel shows 1950, the middle panel 2000, and the upper panel 2015. It shows the pictures of the megacities. So down in 1950, there was only one city with more than 10 million people, and there were seven cities between 5 and 10 million. If you go up to the top, the height of each red bar indicates the population of the city, and you can see a multiplicity of cities with millions and millions of people in them. 21 cities with more than 10 million, and 37 cities with between 5 and 10 million. So those are notable, they're worth talking about, but that's not where the bulk of the world's urban population lives. The bulk of the world's population lives in cities with more than a million people. And this shows that by the year 2020, 50% of the world's population will live in cities with more than a million. So that city between a million and 5 million is really where most people will be living before too long. That's a fairly good-sized city. That's not a small town. That's something all of us would agree is a city. So what's it like to put people in a city and take care of them? Is it a good habitat for people? Are there challenges that we face in the wholesomeness of an urban environment in terms of health and welfare? Well, getting water to people is a challenge. When you move lots of people into cities rapidly, as we're seeing happen all over the developing world, getting fresh water to people is a problem. The minority of people have potable piped water in the megacities of the developing world. That means that they're using wells that they have to go to, or they're paying water, or paying money to water sellers who bring water to them. In some cases, using up a substantial proportion of their disposable income just to get water. Sanitation is a major issue. Not many residents in the cities of developing nations have effective sanitation systems. Septic tanks are used in some places, but as a city gets dense, septic systems fail pretty readily because soil can't absorb the amount of sewage that dense populations put there. Pit latrines are simply no facilities at all, and anybody who's been in a city of a developing nation recently understands the aesthetic as well as the health problems that result from that. These are classic sanitary problems. They're still part of sanitary practice in public health, but they're major problems in cities. Housing, the quality of housing, the quantity of housing, the level of crowding that occurs as a part of rapid growth and migration to cities, the suitability of the land on which people build houses. If you go to the edge of most cities, you'll see slopes rising, and you'll see houses improbably pounded into the sides of slopes, ready for the first big rain to knock them down the hill. This is a picture of the proportion of people who live in slums and squatter settlements in particular cities. The upper line is Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, with more than 80% of the population living in informal settlements, Casablanca, Morocco, Kinshasa, Zaire, and so on. Huge proportions of people living in absolutely inadequate housing, which is a serious health threat. pollution control is a problem in cities where industry and dirty transportation are still commingled. Mass transit, getting people where they have to go, is a real challenge. Waste management is a challenge. The ecological footprint, the impact of the city on resources regionally and even farther afield than that. We'll talk about the ecological footprint of cities a little bit later. The social disruption that comes with the transformation of people moving to cities. All of these are challenges of cities in the developing world. On the other hand, there are some benefits and advantages. There are some economic arguments, citing the fact that cities tend to be the engines of national economic growth in developing nations. That's where the economy is pulled along. If you want to develop industry in a poor country, you go to the city to do it because that's where the labor is. And cities are economically efficient for their size. That's an economic argument in favor of cities. In fact, you can appreciate reduced costs through economies of scales in providing many of the services that are necessary for health and quality of life. All the things listed here, I won't read them to you, but cities offer great advantages. So if you do it right, cities can be livable and resource efficient places for people to live. And if you do it wrong, or if you still haven't done it, it's just happening without much planning, then some of those challenges that I mentioned are absolutely enormous. The city as an environmental phenomenon. Well, this concept of the ecological footprint, have you talked about that in this class yet? The idea is that for all of us, let's say we were the population of Boston, we're a subset of the population of Boston with a few visitors from Maine. In order for us to do the things we do, we eat lunch, everybody ate lunch today, and the lunch that you ate involved food, most of which didn't come from Boston. In fact, if it was an American meal, then the average item that you ate for lunch traveled 1,300 miles to get to you. And since we're accustomed these days to eating fresh food, even in the off season, which is now, lots of the fruits and vegetables that were part of your lunch had to come from the southern hemisphere or from greenhouses. That means that there was an ecological impact from the food that you ate. There's cropland somewhere that gave rise to that food, and there are fossil fuels that were used to power the transportation that brought the food to you. The building that we're in now, and the homes that you inhabit, and the roads that you'll travel on the way from here to home after class, all required resources that came from somewhere else. So forests were cut to make the wood that made this lectern, and coal is being pulled out of the ground somewhere to power the power plant that's keeping these lights on, and so on. You can appreciate that many of the activities and services and goods that comprise a city come from outside the city. And so it's possible to envision the ecological footprint of a city. How big is the area in acres that gives rise to the city itself? And it turns out that it takes many more acres than the land area of a city itself to supply and support the city. It's not a counterintuitive concept. You can calculate how big your own ecological footprint is. You can calculate how big a city's ecological footprint is. And it turns out that cities can either have relatively small or relatively enormous ecological footprints. They're always going to be bigger than the city. But the way the city is managed and the way people use goods and services has everything to say about how big the ecological impact of the city is and how much land area equivalent is used to manage the city. I mentioned at the bottom there implications for the post-oil city, and we're going to come back to this at the end, I hope. But one of the very interesting big picture questions to ask is what happens when oil becomes scarce? And that is expected to happen sometime around now. We're only going to know about it in the rearview mirror, but around 2005 or so is when Hubbert's peak, the peak of oil production, has been predicted to occur. After that, oil production will decline, demand will continue to increase, and we'll see increasing scarcity of oil. Well, when that happens, many of the things that we need to make cities function, like transporting goods in from elsewhere using fossil fuels, will become more difficult. And so that ecological footprint, the way we live in cities, and the way we run cities, and the impact of cities on the rest of the environment may all change when petroleum becomes a scarcer input than it is now. Well, what's urban health? Has anybody heard the phrase urban health? You may have. It's a subfield of public health. And interestingly, very interestingly, typically urban health has been defined as the health of poor people who live in cities. It has a lot to do with drug abuse and HIV and violence and some of the plagues that plague inner city neighborhoods. I'm going to propose that urban health means a whole lot more than that. I want to base this in the broad concept of the epidemiologic transition. Raise your hand if you're familiar with this concept. So a few, most of you are, half of you are anyway. Those in public health probably are, and those from other disciplines may not be. The idea, this is sort of a standard paradigm in public health history. The idea is that public health has moved through phases over historical time. The first phase there is the age of pestilence and famine. We don't have a light here, do we? So I'll just, you can look up there. What you see is that the birth rate's high and the death rate's high. Those are the two lines. And they wiggle with respect to each other. So at times, the death rate exceeds the birth rate. Oh, thanks, Eric. Okay. So here, at times, the death rate exceeds the birth rate during times of disease, pestilence, famine. And at times, the birth rate is higher. But in general, they're both high, and the population remains low. Then you move into the age of receding pandemics, where the death rate comes down fairly precipitously, but the birth rate remains fairly high. That means that the population mushrooms. Okay? Then you move forward into the age of degenerative and man-made diseases, and the birth rate comes down, as we're seeing happen in many developed countries these days. Even in such an unlikely place as Italy, the birth rate is below replacement now. And so as the birth rate comes down, it approximates the death rate again. Population remains stable, although in some cases quite high. And then we'll move into something called the age of delayed degenerative diseases, which has biological interest, but not so relevant in today's context. Well, if you can appreciate that there are stages of epidemiologic reality that comprise the history of public health, let me propose to you that there's also an epidemiologic transition of cities. The meaning of urban health is going to change over time as what cities look like change over time. First comes the age of pestilence and filth. These are names that I made up, so you can like it or not. Next comes the age of industrial pollution. Next comes the age of social pathology. And finally, the age of urban sprawl. And it's that last one that I'm going to focus on. But let me take you through these stages. This is an oversimplification, but I want to propose that for the sake of conceptual argument, we identify the identity of a city in health terms at various stages in a city's development. So the age of pestilence and filth, this is Boston. This is Boston when Dr. Shivian first began practicing medicine here. And here it is a few years later when Howie Hu and I came to start public health school. So this is a small settlement by the water. There weren't sewage systems. There were pit latrines, or you would just pour it out the window if you were lucky enough to have a second or third floor window. There wasn't piped water, so you dug wells. Now, you can appreciate what happens. If you dig wells and you're putting your waste in pit latrines, the water table is shallow, the water gets contaminated pretty soon, and infectious diseases were a major issue in cities. We began to identify cities with the transmission of infectious diseases regularly. The cholera epidemics of the 19th century were urban affairs. This is an announcement that you can't bury your cholera victims in the cemetery because it's all full up. This is a yellow fever picture, a contemporary drawing in a newspaper cartoon in New Orleans in the late 1700s. Cities were places where you got infected, and you fled the city during epidemics if you could. Nevertheless, cities continued to grow. And as the Industrial Revolution took place, industries located in cities, they were by waterways, and it was relatively easy to get the fuel that you needed to drive industry, and cities became popular places. So here you have early industry, typically located in cities, right near where people lived. Here's an example. This is the Cyclops Steelworks at Sheffield, England. And what's interesting about this picture is that the residential properties are just here alongside the industrial properties, and all the smoke from the smokestacks comes over here where the people who live here can breathe it. Now, I always look at this picture and I imagine these three guys in their top hats talking, and I think they must be realtors. And just like modern day realtors, they're talking about the housing that's over there in the yellow arrows, and they're saying what realtors always say about housing, location, location, not a great location to live. Pittsburgh in 1890, contemporary travelers left accounts that as you came across Pennsylvania westward, you could see the smoke column from the city long before you saw the city itself. And here it is today. This is a town in New Jersey. Is anybody from New Jersey? Yeah. What's interesting about this is that you have the tank farm in the background, and you have industrial petrochemical facilities in the foreground, and housing nestled in between them. So although we've begun typically separating residential from industrial property development, that's not a full separation in some places, and we still see that industrial exposures take place in cities. But as industry developed in cities, as pollution and smoke became a fact of life and a defining feature of urban health, huge migrations from rural areas to urban areas occurred. In this country, it occurred in waves in the 1700s and 1800s and into the early 1900s. And that process of urbanization was itself a toxic process. You began to see crowded tenements like you see here. You began to see substandard residential properties like you see here. Jacob Riis famously cataloged the way people lived in New York City in the early 1900s with pictures like these. It's interesting, this is a very interesting, this is supposed to be a story about environmental health, but interestingly, this book from Jacob Riis, this picture from Jacob Riis's book is labeled Street Arabs in Sleeping Quarters, an early example of racism, a sort of racial discrimination that isn't really practiced this explicitly now, but there it was. It's an interesting use of the word. This is my city. This is Atlanta. In the 1930s, there's the state capitol in the background, and houses where African-American migrants from rural areas to urban areas lived. And that mixture of the concentration of poverty, the racial tensions, the inadequate infrastructure in cities led to tremendous social ferment, so that when you thought about health in a city, you didn't necessarily think about infectious diseases like cholera. You didn't necessarily think about industrial pollution. You thought about getting mugged or stabbed or raped. And people actually fled cities out of fear. The summer of 67, there were 130 urban riots across the United States, and urban health now had an entirely different connotation than it had in the past. That has been supplanted to some extent by urban sprawl. In fact, that was one of the drivers for urban sprawl. Beginning in the post-war years, people began moving out in enormous numbers from cities to outlying areas that became called suburbs. Here's Denver, expanding until it hits the Rocky Mountains when it's going to have to stop growing. So vast geographic expansion of this and many other cities. Transformation of land use from traditional agricultural and forest to residential, as you see here. Meanwhile, as the city's expanding outward, in the central city, you have perfectly good infrastructure like this. You have soundly constructed buildings. You have utility lines, water lines, sewage lines, mm-hmm. electric lines falling into disuse as poverty concentrates in the central city and much of the wealth moves outward. Not an efficient way to use resources, is it? If you wanted to think just in terms of efficiency, you would use existing infrastructure rather than building all new infrastructure. Low density use of land, another feature of urban sprawl. We've talked about the geographic expansion of cities, the transformation of traditional land uses. Low density use of land, here you have one house on an acre or 2 acres, far lower density than you saw in traditional cities and towns. That has implications for transportation. I've talked about land use so far, but land use and transportation are the two sides of the urban form coin. Everybody who lives in these houses isn't going to bike anywhere, isn't going to walk anywhere, because every place is too far away. The spread out nature of the city, the low density form of development, means that distances that need to be traveled are large. And so we put vast amounts of resources into superhuman acts of construction like this. But still, that's not enough to prevent, well, there's this. Does anybody know where this is? This is actually not a trick photo. This is in Waltham. This is just off 128. It's amazing what people can do. But every major American city, every morning and every afternoon, still suffers a scene like this. It's quaintly called rush hour, as if it only lasted an hour. It's usually 2 or 3 hours in the morning and another 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Now, coming down from the regional scale to the neighborhood scale, the typical form of a suburban neighborhood is what's often called the loop and lollipop development, and you can see here why it has that name. It features low connectivity. To get from this point, which is only 100 yards or so, is difficult because you have to travel like this. Curvaceous roads, single-use land use, another feature of urban sprawl. If you look at a scene like this, what you don't see is stores, libraries, churches, schools. This is all residential. So the person who lives here who wants to go get a loaf of bread or a newspaper is going to have to get in the car and drive somewhere to run that errand. This is a very automobile-dependent form of human settlement. Is anybody here a medical student? Okay, well, I'll talk about the oncology of sprawl. If this relates to any disease process, it would be the process of tumor development. You see dedifferentiation with a highly monotonous form of home developing. This is a cellular phenomenon. You see neovascularization in the roadways. You see coagulopathy in the rush hour twice a day. Outgrowing the nutrient supply, this little lake, which may have been a perfectly good lake and source of water for a low density population around here in past years, is now completely inadequate. And central necrosis, that's the downtown area. We've talked about what happens to downtowns already. Here it is schematically. In the upper half of this picture, you see a conventional suburban development pattern these days, and in the lower part, you see a traditional grid-like town or city form. So grid-like streets, high connectivity, lots of ways to get from point A to point B, and an admixture of different land uses. So you see retail, single-family stores, single-family homes, a mall, apartment houses, all fairly contiguous with each other. Up above, in contrast, you see a different approach to land use. You see separate parcels of land developed for different purposes, single-family homes here, apartments here, the school over here. A kid who wants to go back to the school to toss a frisbee one afternoon has a very different journey above than below. This kid goes out of the house along the street, probably on a sidewalk, which is a typical asset of grid-like development in towns and cities, and gets to school. This kid, same distance from the school as this one, has to go out here, down onto the feeder road, along the feeder road and into the school. That requires mom or dad to give you a ride, the last damn thing in the world you want to have to depend on when you're 14 years old. So very different behavioral implications from the two land use patterns. Coming down to a smaller scale, this is a particular asset that I really like thinking about. This is a factory, B, a medium security prison, C, a UFO that just landed, D, a school. This is a school. Everybody reckon this is what schools look like. It's unbelievable, isn't it? Governing Magazine is a magazine for elected officials, and it ran this cover story last year called Education, the Compulsion to Build Schools in the Middle of Nowhere. Typical pattern is that if your school district needs to build a school, you find a 40-acre parcel way out there, looks something like this, and you put the school in there. Well, every kid from now until the end of that school's useful life is going to have to travel to the school by motor vehicle, not by walking, not by bus. And the traditional role of a school as a community gathering place is made impossible. This is my favorite. This is the Hubbard Lake Elementary School in Michigan, whose motto is outstanding in its field. This is 7 miles from the nearest town. Now, coming down to the streetscape, this is a typical roadway in a rapidly growing suburban area. Does this look familiar to you? It's, no matter where you're from, you've seen this, because this is a ubiquitous scene. This happens to be in Atlanta. This is a road called Buford Highway. The virtue of streets like this is that they can move a lot of traffic. They're designed to do that. The other virtue is that they allow us to play a fun game called Find the Victim. So here is the victim here. This intrepid pedestrian is attempting to cross and hopefully won't get killed. This stretch of road actually has the highest fatality rate of any stretch of road in Atlanta, but others that are built the same way are the other rivals. Here is a cartoonist's view. This is the Baltimore Beltway in the year 2025. Is anybody from Baltimore? Baltimore. Well, let me explain the geography to you. This is after the Beltway has been newly widened to 1,472 lanes. And up here to the north is the New York Beltway that formerly was known as the state of New Jersey. And this is the Washington Beltway down here, and here's I-95, signifying 95 yards between the two beltways. The human impact of this form of development is reflected in this car, where the child says, "Mommy, when are we going to be home?" And mommy says, "We spend 60 hours a week in our car, honey. This is our home." So again, implications of land use and transportation patterns for the way people live. That pastoral impulse to leave crowded, scary cities and go to the countryside for a little bit of peace, that impulse has turned into a picture that may feel and look more like this sometimes. Coming down to the sidewalk level, and this is the smallest scale I want to talk about before I turn to health implications. I've made a careful study of sidewalk design around the country from a public health point of view. This is not official CDC research. And what I've discovered is that there is a diabolical conspiracy called the National Never Walk Campaign. Somebody out there is trying to prevent any Americans from ever walking, presumably to contribute to the obesity epidemic. Let me tell you what the main strategies are in the National Never Walk Campaign. First, you don't build sidewalks. So you have roads like this that just are built completely unfriendly to pedestrians. This is the concept of a complete street, which you may have heard of, means a street that serves travelers in cars, on foot, on bikes, people with and without disabilities, the elderly, the young. This is the opposite. This is the incomplete street without a sidewalk. But you can see that, unfortunately, some people insist on walking anyway. They kind of look like this. These are people who can't afford a car. And so we need 10 more strategies to complete the campaign against walking. We can build repellent sidewalks like this, where you're right up against traffic, you're not shaded from the sun, there's nothing interesting to look at as you walk along, so nobody in his right mind who has a choice in the matter would ever walk here. Third is you can allow sidewalks to disintegrate. This is a common scene in many areas where there just isn't enough maintenance funding for sidewalk maintenance. You can build treacherous sidewalks. This is nice because it slopes down right into a busy street. So let's say you're taking a walk and you have your child in a stroller and you slip and the stroller goes into the street. This is a very effective strategy because a car will remove that child from the gene pool. And if that child was about to inherit your predilection to walking, that won't happen anymore. Obstructing sidewalks is a very effective strategy. This sends a clear signal to people about what we think of walkers. Now, this is an example. This is a big pole in the sidewalk. It's a pretty narrow sidewalk, so these fellows clearly had to step out into traffic to continue on their journey, and that shows why obstructing sidewalks is so effective. This is very close to the Emory campus, not too far from where I live. A hurricane came through, knocked down some trees. The highway department, God bless them, was out there within hours, and they took the chainsaw. Now, they could have made the cut here, but no, they made the cut here so that nobody could continue walking there. Creative design is very good. I think medical imagery is helpful here. I call this sidewalkus interruptus, and it sends a signal. This is just dislocation. Now, crosswalks are the connectors that take you from one sidewalk to another. A crosswalk should lead nowhere, because there's no reason anybody would ever walk to the crosswalk if it doesn't lead any place where you'd want to walk to. This is a very common design feature. It's efficient to combine multiple strategies at times of scarce resources. So here we have obstruction and disintegration together. Here we have sidewalkus interruptus and obstruction. It's a good way. Never place an interesting or useful destination within walking distance of where anybody lives. If you build places like this, it prevents anybody from walking because there's no place to walk to. Even if somebody builds sidewalks, you can be sure nobody will walk on them. Just say it. Now, this is nice. It's nice to be direct. This is a gated community. This is the fastest growing form of urban, of residential development in the country. And if you look carefully as you approach this place, it says no pedestrians. You're actually not allowed to arrive on foot. You have to be in a car. When gas goes to $10 a gallon, it's going to be great to see how people actually come to this place. And finally, make everything car accessible. Don't just repel people from walking, but make it easy for them. Make it inescapable for them to drive. We have drive-through pharmacies. We have drive-through cleaners. We have drive-through booze. Notice that drive-through is always spelled T-H-R-U. This is very considerate because drivers have better things to do than actually negotiate something like an O-U-G-H. So we make it easy for them. Drive-through bakeries, drive-through grocery stores. We have drive-through automobile service establishments appropriately. You can fill all your dietary needs on a drive-through basis. You can then wash it down with a cup of coffee that you get on a drive-through basis. Drive-through banking. This is especially nice. If you look carefully at this, if you look at the little console there, it has buttons that are in Braille, so even blind drivers can fully utilize this resource. We have drive-through mailboxes. We have drive-through opportunities to pay utility bills. You can get married on a drive-through basis, but I think the only place is in Las Vegas. This is the tunnel of vows, like the tunnel of love. And here they are, the newly betrothed, in a car. If things don't work out and they have to get a divorce in this particular courthouse in Alabama, you can actually drive up to make your child support payments there, and those two ladies will accept your money. And speaking of life cycle events, we have drive-through funeral homes where you can, I guess the motto here is break for the wake. You can actually drive up and wave to the dearly departed and never get out of your car. And for those who love irony, this is my favorite. Anybody who can explain this to me wins an award. And finally, drive-through trees, being that this is America. Well, what's the result of all this? We have 11 strategies at least to prevent us from walking as if it were a diabolical scheme. We, in fact, are left with urban ecosystems that have engineered walking, or non-motorized transit, as it's called in the transportation world, out of existence.
From a series of lectures organized at the Harvard Medical School in February 2006, this is Howard Frumpkin from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention speaking about how we could make our cities more livable and the problems that we have when cities are not designed to human scale.